and start the recording, just so I don't forget to stop the recording.
I haven't found my pen.
Here's the pen. So do you, I don't have anybody online yet, so you're my only student at the moment. Do you have any questions
from this past week's work?
So thankfully I can say no, I aced my quiz.
See, wasn't that a nice feeling?
Yeah, well, and I was like, I don't understand why, because it's like the most complicated thing.
See, I thought it would be the hardest, but...
But I think for me, my brain actually isn't as intimidated by numbers. I'm more intimidated by, like, this week's lesson.
Oh, really?
Which I did not get. Like, I did not get it. So, I'm glad I'm in class so you can teach it to
me. All right. Do you have no background in statistics at all?
No. I don't know if that's a high school class people
took,
but I did not.
Not one that's required. It's one that
is sometimes one of the options.
And so,
yeah, there you go.
Okay.
Life is
working like they're supposed to. So we're definitely going to get into that, but I thought maybe people would have some questions. I did have one question that somebody submitted online. It's I'm going to address it a little bit here to start with. I was asked because I kind of, she said, you really hurried through. And I was like, yeah, I probably did. The business about the national debt.
Yeah, federal.
And the federal debt and the implications towards Social Security and all of that. I think it's, yeah, there we go, 4F. Mm-hmm. The title of that section is Understanding the Federal Budget, and they use a lot of accounting terms, and I would be the last person you should ask about that, because I have never taken an accounting class, ever. Understanding... the federal budget. And so when I was first looking for textbooks for this class and I was reviewing this one, this is the first time I ever had much understanding of the federal budget, to be completely honest, and why some things are said and you think, well, that can't be true, and I don't understand why they're saying that. I like this section. I think it's helpful for us as citizens to be maybe more aware of this than we are. So I'm going to just talk about it a little more slowly than I did last week and reference a couple of the key diagrams that I think are important and the key pages to maybe reread and think about. The first one is from page 272. There are two pie charts. There. And those two pie charts are first talking about where does the federal government get their money? Revenue is their income, okay? So how does money come in that belongs to the federal government? And we see that our income taxes, personal income taxes, make up 40% of the income. All right, almost half. Depends on what people pay when it's time to do their taxes. And then there's corporate income taxes. I am always surprised that number is as low as it is. Yeah, I always assumed businesses were contributing about equally with people, you know? Oh, that's not true. It's not true at all. So then when there's a discussion about should we raise or lower corporate taxes and is this a tax-friendly environment or not a tax, you know, I always think that they're only paying 10%. I mean, you know, how bad can that be? But anyway, so they're paying 10%. Businesses are paying 10%. They talk about excise taxes and this other, mysterious other, I don't know what goes in there, but those are very small slices of the pie. And then the other sizable portion is Social Security, Medicare, and other social insurance receipts. So what we should read that as, I think,
is doesn't it say 34%?
Yes.
It's the green one.
All right. That is FICA.
So you think about every time you get a paycheck, the FICA that has been withdrawn, okay, that gets mailed directly to the federal government. So that counts as part of their revenue stream.
Part of the income to the, so
every person earning a paycheck, with very few exceptions, is paying their FICA taxes. Most of us, the employer pays half and we pay half. People who are self-employed have to pay double because they're paying on both sides of that. But that makes up a third of the federal budget. So this money gets in, personal income tax gets in,
corporate income tax gets in,
and a little bit more. All right. That's how the government gets their money. Okay, so one third of their income.
This is revenue means income. This is the money coming in.
Okay. So then we go over, and the other pie chart is talking about money going out. How does the federal government spend money?
And so this is also, I think, a very interesting pie graph
to be able to compare these different categories. I don't think most of us walking around realize what these categories really are, okay? Everything that looks purple, Social Security, Medicare, Medicaid, pensions, you know, retirements, and the interest on our debt. So everything that's purple,
those are often called entitlements.
Because people in different categories are entitled to this money, okay? Retired people have paid into Social Security. Now they're retired. They're entitled to their retirement that they invested in. Medicaid is an entitlement that we pay because we believe that all families should have health care, even if they can't afford it. And so this part here, now this represents a huge part of the budget. You notice it's significantly more than half of the budget. 20, 46, 52, 65, I think if I added quickly, but hopefully not too far off.
This is 65% of the budget.
And this 65% of the budget is non-negotiable. It automatically renews. So when we talk every year about is Congress going to pass a budget or not,
you know, are we going to have a budget or are
they going to fight about it and shut down the government and a lot of different things have happened, we're not even talking about this 65%. It's just a done deal. It goes in. Some of these things could be changed, but it would take acts of Congress. You know, it would be heated and unpopular because all of them are titled to money that people now expect to get.
Okay.
Because they paid it. Yes. Well, some of them have paid it. Some of them, like, you talk about Medicaid, and it's like, well, okay, they didn't pay it, but do I want to be the person who says this child doesn't get their shots or that handicapped person doesn't get, I mean, you know, no. As Christians, that's pretty hard for us to say. No, they just shouldn't get any treatment. They ought to go get a job. Some of them aren't even capable of getting a job, you know, and so these are very unpopular things to change. They just go automatically. They're automatically renewed every year. So that means when they're trying to set a budget, they're talking about 35% of the budget.
Okay, so only 35% is annually decided.
Every year they determine how are we going to spend 35% of our money. 65% of our money, it's already decided. So out of this 35%, all of our defense spending is in there, okay? And then they divided it into defense and homeland security versus non-defense. So after you take out defense funding, military, homeland security, which I think has the bigger half of the 35, yeah, slightly, okay, then you're down to just 16.
And that
16% has to pay everything else that the federal government does. Okay, it's paying for parks, it's paying for roads, it's paying
everything.
Okay, it's paying for the research labs, it's paying for NASA, it's paying on and on. You know, when you really start thinking about it, it's like all those things that we think about the federal government paying for is really only like 16% of our budget. here's the big piece of our budget, these things.
Okay.
So this is where the money goes. This is how it's spent. And this is how the money comes in. Okay, so far, so good. You keep reading in this section, and you roll around to the last three pages in this section. 276 to 278. And here's what you learn. Every year, when all this FICA money comes in,
okay,
it gets deposited into the FICA account. So 34% of the income goes into FICA. Okay.
Then they pay these entitlements over here,
which they're technically negative 30% on.
Well, so they pay these, and they fully pay these. Everybody gets their check. The retired people get their Social Security right. check. Medicare people get their check. Medicaid people get their check. This gets fully paid, and there's leftover money. We'll talk about why there's leftover money in a minute. But more money comes in than is owed. So the money comes in. We pay everybody we have to pay. And then what we all believe is balance
is saved.
Most people that are paying into Social Security are picturing their money in a little account with their name that they're later going to pull out. I mean, I really believe the majority of people, that's how they see Social Security working. I know that's how I always saw it. It's like, wait, that's my money. It's not my money. It's the government's money. I paid it to them. It's now theirs. It's left my hands. It's gone into theirs. This doesn't happen.
Instead, they put in what are, in essence,
IOUs.
You know, the nice name for these is treasury bills.
But they are really just glorified IOUs. And then they take the money and they go spend it on other things that are up here.
Okay.
So this money gets pulled out and used up here so that we can have a little more money to distribute with the roads and a little more money to distribute with the parks and a little more money for those other things that we want. And they're good things, but it means this account is really sitting here empty. Well, this would be great if we could just keep doing it. If we always had more money coming in than we owed, who would really care? But here's the deal.
Now with 17 trillion,
we have to talk about the nature of our population.
I am
a member of the baby boomer generation. I'm at the end, but this is my generation. I must claim it, okay? This is a large group. And they've been in the workforce. They've been generating money, and they've been paying in. So they've been over here sending in their payments and sending in their payments. But now, many of these people, and literally more every year, are moving over here where they expect to begin
receiving their money,
okay? Instead of being the paying in crowd, they're becoming the receiving crowd. Well, all the generations that are underneath this group are smaller, and they are less employed. And so there's higher unemployment in that crowd, and there's also they're just getting lower paying jobs, or they're just more inclined to only work 30 hours a week because I want better balance in my life with other things, which can be a good thing. I'm not arguing against that, but the impact it has here is less money is going to go into, you know, baby boomers are inclined to work 50 plus hours a week. And that's not so much true of the more recent generations. So both because of the work ethic and the emphasis placed on work in that generation, and because of the sheer numbers of the people, we have fewer people paying in and more people moving over into this category and becoming receivers. And let's add on, we're living longer, so we need to receive for more years. We ran out of money. We can't keep doing this. And all those IOUs, nobody wants to receive an IOU in the mail, okay? They actually want cash. They want to be able to do something with it. So this is what is going on with the budget. And I really, you know, it behooves us as citizens of this nation to be a little more aware of this. And as we're electing people and as we're listening to conversations that go on in Congress about what are we going to do about the budget, and what decisions are we going to make about personal retirement, you know, you want to ask yourself questions like, can I really count on my Social Security? Or do I need to make another plan because likely it's not going to pay me? What do I believe should happen here? What do I believe is ethical? What do I believe is morally responsible? What do I think is financially responsible? And they're not easy questions, but I do think they're questions we should be thinking about and we should be aware of. So, you know, we wouldn't run our own budget this way. We couldn't because the only income I have, you know, it's a, the same people are paying in and receiving, so, you know, it works differently. But we need to think about what's going on here and what we believe about it. So that's just a little bit more on 4F because I was asked to be a little clearer about that than I had been. I rushed last week. Always run out of time. Okay, let's see who's joined us online in the meantime. Hi, Brittany.
Hi. I have a question for you. I'm not going to be able to stay online the whole time because we're really busy at work. I just had to come in and ask a question.
Oh, sure. Well, then let's get to your question. Go right ahead.
Okay, well, it's nothing to do like with this. It's just about the quizzes. Okay, so I'm having really trouble. I know it was last week, but I'm having really trouble passing that practice quiz. Because I'm messing up on the IPY and the IPR, I think it was.
Yes.
I'm messing up on those, and I keep messing up. And I don't know where I'm going wrong.
And so that's the one topic you would like me to address real quick for you?
Yes, if you could. That's the only thing, like, I'm having really trouble with. Like, I cannot pass the practice quiz. Like, I'll get a 70.
You should also know that if I see that you have been online and working hard, I mean, you've been diligent, then I will try to remember to email Kyle and ask him to give you access to that weekly quiz, even if you haven't hit the 80, because I hate for you to take a zero when you've worked.
Yeah, I've been trying, and then like I got a 70, a 50, and I think a 70.
Okay, so anyway, you let me know if you didn't actually get it taken because
I didn't get the actual quiz taken because of that.
Okay, I will probably try to go in and see if we can get you set up to get you in and to actually take it if I can see your scores in there. Because I don't, you know, even if you only make a 50 or a 70, that's going to be a whole lot better than zero. I only have it set.
Hoping about
to, because I don't want somebody to get in such a hurry to get there that they cheat themselves and they get a really low score because they didn't really have a skill before they got in. So
yeah, I keep giving 70s and I was like, well, I know it closes at 6 o'clock today, and then I tried it again like right before, like at like when I could again at like 5:15.
Okay.
I made a 70 again, and I was like, well, I don't know what I'm going to do.
All right. I will help you out with that later. So I'll send you an email so that you know what you need to do and all okay. that, because I do want you to at least take it. But in the meantime, you have honed in on where your question is, and so let's try to figure that out. I was trying to find it in the book here. I know I had a slide on it last week. Here we go.
Yeah, and can we watch the recordings without answering the questions if we do the live too?
Oh, yeah. You can go in and look at whatever you want, and you don't have any response because I've already recorded, you know, I've already given your participation grade based upon our interaction in class.
Okay, that's what I was wondering because I was like, I was like, I don't want to go on there and then not answer the questions and then get a zero for participation.
No. If I've already talked with you in class, you can't lose your participation. And you can certainly go in and look at those recordings if they are helpful to you.
Yeah, okay. That's what I was trying to do that because I know we went over it last week, but I didn't know if I could do that and just go in and do it.
Okay, there we go. All right, so APY and APR, on page 208, they are defined at the top of the page in green,
okay?
And what really, effectively, the most important thing you need to know is going on here is if you compound your interest only once a year, okay? So for annual
interest. APR and APY
are the same thing. They will be equal all of the time, okay? If, however, you start compounding your interest more than once a year, then the APY is going to be higher.
Okay.
Because now you're earning interest several times. So some of your money is earning interest more than once. It basically is what it comes down to. It gets more than one interest payment. So the example six that's right there in the middle of the page, they use the formula for amount where you have N for the number of times it's been compounded. We have an investment of $1,000 in that problem. And now we're earning monthly interest, okay? So now it's 1,083, okay? And so if you do, that's a gain of $83, 83 out of 1,000, you find out that that's 8.3, even though the APR was only 8%. So the actual money gained was $83 in a year. It was in an 8% account, but when you actually calculate that percentage, $83,
you know, this is my interest divided by my $1,000, which was my principal.
Because we're asking ourselves, what percent of 1,000 is 83? Okay.
I see what I did wrong.
All right. This is always the hoped for goal. There we go. So this would be my APY. Whereas my APR was 8%.
I was, for some reason, moving the decimal over on the 8%. Like, if it was 8%, I was moving the decimal over and multiplying it by 0.8.
Uh-huh.
$1,000.
Uh-huh.
So now I see what I was doing wrong.
Okay. Excellent.
Thanks.
Is there anything else we can do for you while you're checked in?
That was all.
All right. Thanks so much for stopping. All right. I saw I had somebody else in class. Brittany, you're next on my list. Was I just talking to you?
Yeah.
Sorry. I thought you were going to leave like right immediately. Never mind. You can hang out as long as you've got time. Christine, what can I do for you today during office hours?
I think I'm okay this week.
All right. It was a good week, and you were happy
yes.
to say that. Huh? Okay. I always like it when we have a good week.
Yeah, I was a little bit surprised when I saw the results from the test one.
All right. I would talk about test one, but not everybody has turned it in, I am sad to report, even though it's now a week late. So that, you know, that's another conversation. But anyway, I can't really freely talk about it at this point. But it won't be on the next test anyway. So for good or bad, it's done. Robbie, what can I do for you?
Well, I actually got 100%.
Man, you are one happy. You're one happy person, aren't you?
That is just crazy. So thank you. And I did. You know, for some reason, let me just take a peek here.
Sure.
It was the IRAs with, I don't know, it took me like 20 minutes to figure this question out.
Hey, but you did it. That's a good thing.
That's true. That's true.
Most of the time, really, no one's holding a gun to our head. We don't have to think all that fast. If we can just think clearly, it's going to get the job done. We're all not on a game show, so it's all right.
That's true. So I guess I'm good.
You're good. All right. Well, you're who I have. Somebody came in to keep me company.
Hi, everyone. I don't know if you can see me, but this is Hannah. I'm in class. You get to hear a lot from me tonight.
Can you see Hannah in class?
No.
No. That probably means I need to change something on my camera.
Except I probably don't know what that is, but I'll look.
No, you'll need to change it and put that setting on up there. So that's that camera.
This camera, okay.
And that's the one that
you All right. Watch. Well, I see that Gary's online and monitoring, so we'll see if he decides to try.
I'll come up and fix that. I didn't know anybody was going to be in the classroom.
Well, it was my happy surprise for the night. Hannah came to see me.
Yeah. So I would be I'll be right up.
Thank you. You see how great my technical skills are. This is why I tell you, don't ask questions about technology. I will not be able to answer them. Okay, well, if no one else has additional questions, then we might just go ahead and start conversations about this week's work.
So can we ask questions from the practice quiz then, or not?
I was thinking it might make sense
to kind of go through a section, and then if you have a question that was related to that, then if you still have a question, we'll ask it.
If I cleared it up when I went through lecture, then we won't, you know, stop and do it, and just kind of process through it that way. That's okay.
Usually nobody wants to be around you, so
I know. See, you're so sweet, and I don't even have Sarah online as a witness that you're mean to me, too, after you were so mean to her.
I know. I consider an apology.
Yeah, I saw that. It was popping up while I was trying to pay attention to Professor Long.
It was supposed to be a private chat, but anyway.
Oh, maybe that was.
I don't know.
I didn't see it, thank goodness, or I'd have been totally distracted, right?
I left my beard in the old video, that's right.
They can't see Hannah.
Right, I need to change it to mini cam.
Got it.
Yeah, wait a minute.
So wait, are they only going to see me?
No, we'll fix that too.
Okay.
Because
I'm not actually teaching the class, so...
You get to be
would
the
you like to?
You no. get to be the star this week.
I actually don't understand this at all, so that would not be good.
She didn't think statistics was her best thing. She came in with questions. Minicam.
Yeah.
All right.
This is what allows us to put two cameras on at the same time.
Well, that's kind of cool.
Except that it's...
That's okay. I don't need to be seen.
Okay, actually, you should be in this one.
There we go. But anyway, we're all on camera, so now.
We need to just see from right there.
Can't quite reach the board from it. It's really a problem.
Now let's see, Phil. Now we'll see Mrs. Long right here and you right there.
Cool. All right.
Although her name is kind of almost covering you up there. Anyway.
It's true.
You could take your phone and join and hold it right here. Have like a selfie going on all night
I'm
long.
Sure that will not be distracting at all. Let's go right ahead and do that, right? Okay. So here we go, starting in... with our conversation about statistics. This week is about statistics. Statistics are used for just everything these days. So much more than you maybe realize. People even quote statistics about things, and sometimes I wonder if they understand the statistic that they just quote. Our favorite math teacher statistic is that 5 out of 3 students have trouble understanding fractions. Because it feels to us like we should get to count some of them twice. They're so frustrating in what they don't know about fractions. But anyway, so statistics is the science of collecting, organizing, and interpreting data. You're looking at what is going on and you're trying to make an overall generalization about it from the small group of people or maybe large group of people that you study. Statistics are the data that describes or summarizes what you did. When we talk about a ball player's statistics, we're talking about this. How well did he or she play, shoot, run, whatever they were doing, okay? So we're not up here collecting data, but rather we are looking at the data which describes their performance, okay? Oftentimes, education statistics also fall in this category. We're looking at the report that describes the performance of our students.
All right, so when you're going to do a statistical study,
there's some very important steps that need to be covered for your study to be valid. Sometimes people do studies and then their work is later dismissed because of the invalidity of their actual work. When their procedure is studied, it's realized that they missed some key steps. There were some things that were not appropriate in how they did their study. So here we go. The first one is you've got to have a stated goal. What is it exactly that you're trying to study? Okay. Then once you know what your goal is, you're going to choose a sample of the population. So if I want to study how students understand slope in Algebra 1, then my population is all students in Algebra 1, but my sample is only those students whose tests I actually look at, okay? And if I want to take my data and say it's true for the general public, then I can't just use my class, because my class does not look like all classes everywhere. I may have more minority students. I may have higher income students than somebody else's class. I may have a lot of different things. Younger students, older students. And so when you're choosing your sample, you have to make certain that your sample looks like your population. And so getting a good sample is a lot of times the hardest thing to do, a valid sample. Once you have your sample, then you collect your data, okay? So I go and I look at their test scores. I get their data, and then I summarize this data according to my sample of interest, okay? What percentage of them mastered the concept of slope? Use the sample statistic then to go back and infer something about the population. Again, if I wanted to do an invalid study, I could just look at my high school students and say, well, in my classroom, 80% of the students mastered the concept of slope. And then I can say, so I think 80% of all Algebra 1 students have mastered the concept of slope. Now, I can say that, but I don't have any good statistical study to back it because the only scores I've looked at are in my classroom, and that does not represent the general population well.
Finally, then, you draw your conclusions.
Okay, so you make an inference, and you draw your conclusions. So we're going to look at a small group, and from that small group, we're going to try to say something about a large group. In an election year,
exit polls are a marvelous example of this sort of statistical study, all right? Because they're just polling people as they leave the polling place.
You know, who did you vote for? Who did you vote for? Who did you vote for? And then they go, oh, look, this is how it's going to go,
all right?
Or they count 10, 15% of the ballots.
And then they go, okay,
this state's going to go this direction. And you're like, wait, 85% of the ballots you haven't even looked at. How can you make this call? But if there's, you know, if it's a wide enough margin, they in fact can, and most of the time, they'll be correct. So you don't always need a large sample. You just need a sample that really does look like your population. So here's this basic procedure in a flowchart. All right, we have, I decide what it is I'm going to do. Then I decide on what my population is, and out of that population, I pull a sample. Remembering my sample needs to look just like my population, just be smaller. Then to this sample, depending on, I'm either looking at their performance, if it's an observational study,
or
if it's like a drug study, out of this sample, I'm going to divide them into two groups, my control group and my study group,
And one of them's going to get my new medication, and the other one's going to get a placebo, and then we're going to see how everybody does. Okay? So when I'm down to the sample statistics, that's where we're drawing our conclusions. Okay? How many people felt better? How many people had less infection? Whatever we're, you know, doing. So we make a decision about how effective the treatment was for this sample group, or how well they did if we're just looking at performance. And then we come over here and we say, based upon my sample, here's what I believe will be true for my population.
Okay, so, but what does population parameters mean?
Population parameters.
So, like, are you going to show that in an example and say, like, this would be what population parameters is?
Yeah, if, we okay. don't, if I don't have one on a slide, I'll show you one in the book. They do a good job of discussing that. All right, so here we go. A representative sample is a sample in which all the relevant characteristics of the sample members are the same characteristics that your general population has. This is the importance of having a good sample, and it really can be difficult to do. So the book mentions four different ways of gathering up your sample. All right? So if I want to just do simple random sampling, you know, I just have a computer generate phone numbers and I call people up and see who I get, something like that. If I want to be systematic about it, then I'm going to take every 10th person or every other person, okay? And I'm going to do that no matter what, who walks in, okay? I don't pay any attention. If I get 8 men in a row and only 2 women, so what? Because I'm doing a systematic sampling. I'm taking every 10th person. Convenient sampling is what a lot of us like to do, but it does not lead to good science, all right? Convenient sampling is what those poor people are doing in the mall who try desperately to convince you that you should come back and take their survey.
Because they only get people
to take the survey at their convenience. You know, if it's convenient for me and I'm not in too big of a hurry, I'll go take your survey. But if I'm in a hurry, I'm not going to go take your survey. And so some groups, just by the nature of the group, will become overrepresented. The retirement group that comes to walk in the mall, you know, their time is considerably freer than my time is at the point in life where I am, holding a full-time job, still having a child at home, you know. And so it's like, they're like, oh, sure, you want me to take a sample, you know, do a study, I'll do a survey for you. And so there's their representation is too heavy with retired people, and they don't have enough younger people. All right, just as an example of the problem with convenience sampling, there's many problems with it.
Stratified sampling, we use this method when we are concerned about differences among the groups. So if I really want to know, is there a difference between men and women, then I have to make certain that my sample has an equal number of men and women. So I'm going to have to randomly choose my men and then randomly choose my women. Okay? But I have to pay attention to both. So this visually gives you a picture of each one of these techniques. And some of these pictures are really funny. Here's my favorite one. Just yell out the window, hey, you, what do you think? That is definitely convenient sampling. You know, and here's
our stratified sampling where we, you know, we separate the, we choose 2 out of every 6 women and 2 out of every 6 men, because we are concerned with both groups, all right?
So could that be based on population? Stratified could be based on any dynamic. It doesn't necessarily have to be a gender.
Right.
It could be ethnicity, culture, religion.
Income, religion, any of those things. Again, my public school job. When we do all these tests that we do in May, this was testing week in my building, so we're tested to death. When we do that, when somebody comes in then and analyzes our data, they don't just take the number for how did the Algebra 1 students do on this test. They break it down. How did the Algebra 1 students in this ethnic group, this ethnic group, every ethnic group that you have enough students in to be a relevant group has to be examined separately. So in my building, we look at numbers for African American, Hispanic, Asian, white.
And some years we have a big enough pool to look at Pacific Islander.
That one kind of comes and goes because it's real borderline group, whether we have enough. And so we have to break those down and put everything in and have a sample from each of those as they're looking at it. So yeah, it can be whatever you're concerned about. All right, so here's our example. Let's see if we can think about this. What we're trying to identify here is what kind of a sample, what method are we using, okay? So if I want to do it and I'm conducting a survey in a dorm, and so I decide I'm going to knock on every 10th door, which one of these methods would that represent?
Systematic.
Systematic. Hey, welcome. Steve's here. I hadn't seen you yet, Steve. Your picture hadn't popped up, so I'm glad you spoke up. Yes, I agree. My diagram here shows every third, but every 10th is like every third. It's a systematic sampling. All right, let me jump forward. There we go. They're going to agree with us because we're smart like that. Here we go. To survey opinions on a proposed new water line, they randomly draw addresses of 150 owners that are in that pool. What kind of a system am I using there?
Simple random.
Simple random. Just pulling those out because that's who we have.
There we go.
In an observational study, okay, two types of statistical studies. One is observational. Researchers are simply observing or measuring characteristics of the sample, but we're not trying to influence or change them. We're not treating them in any way. We're not giving them anything. We're not trying to get them to lose weight. We're not trying to get them to get higher test scores. We're just looking at what they've done, all right? We're looking at the decisions they've already made. In an experiment, you're actually applying some kind of a treatment. You've got a plan, okay, that you're trying to work in order to see what the effects of your plan are. This was my year to be observed in my particular high school. Once you've been observed three consecutive years, when you're new in the building, you get observed and you get graded the first 3 years. And then after that, they allow you to waiver out 2 out of 3 years. You can say you want to be observed, but you don't have to. And I think last year I was going to let them go ahead and do it, and they were like, no, really, we got too many others to do. Wouldn't you love to have a waiver? And I said, okay, that would be fine. You can waiver me out again. But this was my year when it had to be done. And so one of the things that I wrote up that I wanted to look at was we have in my building a policy where every time a student takes a test, every time I give a test to my students, I must give them the opportunity to reassess if they score less than 85. And so then we will not discuss my opinion about this, but this is our policy. And so many of my students, especially the younger ones, like to use that first test,
just to check and see if
maybe they just already know this without doing much of anything. And then if that doesn't go well, they can always reassess. Now, my people that are after an A, they don't do that because they know they've surrendered their A. They can only make an 85 now. But my students who just want to pass, I just want to pass. I just got to keep my parents off my back. I got to pass. This system works okay for them. So I get frustrated sometimes at the large number of reassessors that I have again and again, wondering why it is I'm writing two tests and giving two tests. And so I decided I wanted to see if by doing an email home 3 or 4 days in advance of every test, letting their parents know, hey, your son or daughter is going to have an algebra test on Thursday of this week, whether I could cut back on that number because mom and dad would motivate them to study if they just knew the test was coming. And so this was my experiment, and the treatment that I was applying was that email home. Because they had put into our gradebook for the first time this year the ability to email everybody with one click. And so I didn't have to send those individual emails. I could just type up one email that generically went to all my students' homes and say, hey, there's tests coming. And so I decided to try to use this. And, sure enough, my numbers did go down. It did help. So I was excited about that. But that would be an example of a treatment. So I just want you to know that a treatment is not always a medical thing.
you know, a treatment, this any change you're trying to affect. The treatment group is an experiment is the group of sample members who receive the treatment being tested. Okay. The control group is an experiment who do not receive the treatment being tested. And in truth, my statistical study, which, you know, was just me making this thing up, was less than excellent because I did not have a control group. And truthfully, I should have. But I couldn't figure out how to get it to only, you know, email some of my students. And then I really wasn't certain that would be ethical anyway, because, well, how come his mom always gets an email and I never get those emails? And it's like, that's a place I don't want to go. And so I just did everybody. But it made my study less than excellent because I did not have a control group.
Probably you could have done the students who consistently get A's and probably been okay. But then if you did run into the situation where they didn't get an A, then it would.
Yeah, you know, in a situation where parents talk a lot and one parent finds out they're getting something and the other parent isn't getting, it's just kind of not a good situation to be in. You're not sure how you want to explain that. So I chose not to be in that situation. But anyway, then I didn't have a control group. I teach two sections of the same thing, and I could have like done it with one class and not done it with the other. But those two classes were not the same sample at all. Those two classes behaved differently in every way all year, and so to use one to compare against the other wouldn't have been valid at all. So anyway, it's important in a good study for a treatment and control group to be used selected randomly and to be alike in all respects except for the treatment. So, you know, I didn't have a control group because I didn't have another group that was alike. Like pulling all those A students, my control group wouldn't have been like the rest of them. You know, that would have been two different groups.
Yeah, okay. Yeah.
You want two groups that look exactly the same, except one's getting the call and one's not.
So you would basically have to be taking some of your students who get C's and D's consistently.
And not emailing them.
Exactly. Not, which is, that's where you would get in trouble.
There you go. See, so many ways to get in trouble. So mine was a very casual study designed to keep me out of trouble as well. But maybe have me having fewer retesters. Okay, then there's this thing, the placebo effect. All right, and we all kind of know about this, I think. A placebo doesn't have any active ingredient in it that would effectively treat anything. We used to always talk about giving people sugar pills, you know, and still they feel better just because you gave them something, you know, that sense of now that I'm in treatment, now that I'm getting something, psychologically it makes me feel better. So that's a placebo. So the placebo effect is that sometimes patients just get better because they believe they should be getting better, okay? And so their minds work in their favor. Our minds are very powerful. The other thing that comes into effect if you're doing an experiment where you're trying to effect a change and you want to make a good judgment about whether you got that change or not, and that is the idea of blinding, okay? It is best if we don't know, okay? The participants don't know whether they're getting the real drug or the placebo, okay? They don't know. And it's double blind if the person administering the treatment doesn't know either. Okay? That's the ideal situation. All medical type experiments are done this way, as a double blind. One time, since I moved to Dallas, you know, there's things you can do in the city that you can't do in little towns that I've lived in previously. And one of those is there's people here always looking for participants in various different studies.
So I elected
to participate in one two or three years ago. And it was a first experience for me. It was fine. But it was a double-blind experiment. So I have no idea whether I got the real medication or the fake. And the guy that came in that I saw every week and talked with me and gave me my medication, he didn't know either. Okay, I'm just a number. And the vials just have numbers and all the vials look alike. And he's supposed to give my numbers to me and other people's numbers to them, but he doesn't know what's in it, and I don't know what's in it. Only the people that were later going to look at the data would know, so that he's not influenced. So here's some examples for us to talk about. We want to look at these examples and think about any problems with these studies. And if there was some way that it could have been structured better, so that it would be more valid, okay? So first off is the chiropractor. He performs adjustments on 25 patients with back pain. And afterwards, 18 of the patients say they feel better. So he concludes that the adjustments are an effective treatment. Would this be a valid study? Do you see some problems with this study?
Well, it would be the same thing that yours did. The same problem that you had in your study.
Which was
the control group.
There's no control group. So that's one problem that stood out to me. He does not have a control group. Okay? He treated everybody. Could he have had a control group? How would that work? What might that look like?
What kind of back pain it would be? Or...
Well, since our two groups, our control group and our treatment group, need to have the same characteristics, both groups would have to have back pain.
Okay.
Hopefully similar back pain, okay?
Got it.
So they're both going to have pain to begin with. How do I give them a placebo? I thought this was a little tough in the case of a chiropractic treatment.
That seems kind of hard to me. Like, how do you pretend to treat someone?
Right. You know, I think absolutely unethical for the chiropractor to fake treat them, okay? Mm-hmm. Particularly if he's charging them for the appointment. That's just not going to work on so many levels. So I think it would be a very difficult thing to have that control group. And what are you going to do to that control group so that they feel like they're getting the same thing? They talk about hiring an actor to fake the adjustment. And I was like, that's like pretty far out there. I guess you could, so that you would have your two groups.
But that's really unethical, like you said.
Yeah, so. You certainly would have to have had them signed up knowing you're signing up for a study and you may or may not be getting a real treatment. You know, it's not something where you would just casually decide to do it as a chiropractor, just, you know, like I did with my review. No, we shouldn't do that. Okay, here's the second one for us to think about. This one's not quite so crazy. A new drug for attention deficit disorder is supposed to make affected children less disruptive. So randomly selected children that are suffering from this disorder are divided into treatment and control groups. Again, only with their parents' permission and participation. So that's the kind of thing where you just grab kids off the playground and decide to start treating them. But you've got your two groups. Those in the control group receive a placebo that looks just like the real drug. If the kids talk, you know, what they say they're taking is going to look like the same thing. And then the experiment is single blind. So if it's single blind, who is not in the know?
The kids and their parents won't know if they have the real deal.
There you go. The kids and parents have no idea whether they're taking an actual medication or a fake one. Okay? But the person giving it and doing the study, they do know.
Okay? Because it's only single blind, it's not double blind.
Experimenters interview the children one-on-one to decide whether they become more polite. So how do you feel about this study?
Well, my first thought is, like, having worked with kids with not ADD but ADHD, just because they take medication doesn't make them more polite. It may be able to make them pay better attention, but not, it doesn't really have anything to do with their readers. I don't know if that is actually in here.
Well, so you would say that this is maybe not a good measure or a very fuzzy measure of whether
it's actually working.
Yeah. Well, and which is also kind of related to, it says it's going to make them less disruptive. I think we have to start out by defining what does less disruptive look like. Okay. I've taught kids that if I could just get them to stay in their chair, I'd have been happy. You know, I mean, it's like, I'll take the rudeness, but could we just stay in the chair? So you never know. So I agree with you. I thought that was kind of a problem in this study. Anybody see any other problem with this particular study? Does the fact that it's only single blind give you any cause for concern?
Well, based on the reading material, it was saying that it's preferred to do the double blind because if it was a single blind, then somebody might, you know, give them a little hint or, I mean, you touched on that earlier, but.
Right. Yeah. Or sometimes it's just if I'm the manufacturer, I want my drug to work. I've invested a lot of money in it. Okay. And so I want to see improvement. And so on something as fuzzy as whether or not they're more polite, if I know this is a kid on the medication, I'm probably more inclined to decide they're more polite than if I know it's a kid that's not. Again, a lot of it still comes back to it's such a fuzzy thing that we're measuring here. It's not something we can put in a capsule and find a measurement of. So difficult.
Like I said, like what they could determine is student focus or like a raise in grade point average.
Right. But something like that that's more measurable.
But disruptiveness or yes. Or politeness yeah. or
not. How many times they're out of their seat? How many times they ask you to repeat the question? How many times they said, we're on what page? You know, I mean, all of those things would be reflective of attention, but would be more measurable. They'd be countable. It would be something where you could get some truth.
If it's only a single blind, does that mean the conductor is the one that will choose what child goes into what group?
That would be true, too.
Because that means if they already see a kid who is really rude to start off with, they might not want to put them in the... If they are afraid that the medicine won't work, they might want to put them in the other group.
Right. Yeah. It goes back to you are trying to construct two groups that look the same.
So, you know, if you look at your 20
kids in each group and you'd say, you know, five of these kids are just off the chart, inattentive, and rude, you'd want to put the same number in each group to make it a good population, to make it a valid sample. So, okay, I think this is our last example. What type of statistical study is it? What is the average income of stockbrokers? Are we running an experiment, or are we doing an observational study?
It's observational.
Yeah, okay. They already know how much money they make. We're not doing anything to change that. We just want to see what it is.
Do seatbelts save lives?
You're going to tell anybody to not wear their seatbelt so you can tell? I don't think so. So some things are so unethical, the only thing you can do is do what they call in the textbook a case control study. You know, after the fact, we go back and look at the data and see, you know, are there more survivors in accidents where people are wearing their seatbelts than there are in accidents where people are not wearing their seatbelts. This type of thing was what got my father to start wearing seatbelts. He was at a safety seminar for the place where he worked, and they brought a highway patrolman in. And the highway patrolman simply said, I have never unbuckled a corpse. And my dad was like, okay then, that's pretty good data. You know, and so he decided he could start wearing a seatbelt. Can lifting weights improve runners' times in a 10-kilometer race? What would I need to do if I wanted to investigate that? I need an experiment, Hannah says, okay? And they would agree, okay? We have to run a little experiment here to see if our times get better after we do our weightlifting program.
How about
a new herbal remedy will reduce the severity of colds? What do we need to do there?
Another experiment, double blind.
Yep. A double-blind experiment is exactly what we want, okay? So that nobody is biased by the information that they have, okay? And we can apply, some of them are going to get the herbal remedy, some of them are going to get a placebo,
and then we can determine the length of the cold, which is a measurable thing that would be possible to measure. Okay, last thing in this section talks about margin of error, okay, and a confidence interval, okay? So they say the margin of error is stated as a percentage usually, and then you give your confidence interval for what's likely to be the true population, all right? And so you just take the margin of error and subtract it and add it, and that's going to be your low and high boundary, all right? So it's election night. 52% of the people we surveyed said they were going to vote for Smith. And she just needs a simple majority to win, okay? The margin of error for the poll is stated as 3 percentage points. Do we feel confident she will win? Says she would win, right? That's more than 50. How does the 3 percentage points play in?
Margin of error would say that it's actually only 49.
The low end would be 49.
But the high end would be 55, which is
5%. The high end would be 55. The problem is that low end at 49. If the actual values land at 49 or 50, she's either in a runoff or she lost. Okay? She seems to be in a pretty good position, but we don't want to guarantee a win, okay? Because there's 49, there's 55, and so we're 95% confident that it's going to be somewhere between those two, but that interval leaves her in a losing position and a position of needing to do a runoff, and so we can't really feel confident she will win with those numbers. It would be too close to call, all right? Okay, so that is 4A. Now, did anybody have questions from 4A before I move on to 4B? From your 5, sorry, we're in 5. Yes, we are in chapter 5. Week 4, chapter 5. I'm going to figure out how to get the rest of my things. Anyway, anybody have any questions while I'm looking at my slides here? Nothing at all? Everybody's happy with that one? Okay, let me see if I can get it to give me. I had more than one set. I'm hoping they're here. Otherwise, my job just got harder. It's, sad but workable.
That does say 5A only on there?
Yeah. When I looked at it on my screen, I had a B, C, D, E, that I thought I could see. I thought I did so well, I tried to do this myself this week. Perhaps that was an error. Let's see here.
So it shows right there, you've chosen to show
5A, and that's 5A. All it shows me is 5A. That's a bummer. Okay, oh well, I can also do it without the slides. So, all right, we're good to go with this section though. Let me see. Questions from this section that I was going to talk about. I did pick out a couple. I think 285. Oh, yeah, it is. Okay, on page 284, actually, in your textbook. It's the opener for this chapter. This author does some interesting things on the opener for the chapter. And so I ought to use them more than I do, but I really liked this particular one. The question is, you want to know whether Americans generally support or oppose the new healthcare plan. Interestingly enough, the new healthcare plan being referenced here is the one that we just replaced in a vote, I think, yesterday or today in Congress. So see how quickly your book becomes outdated. So which of the following approaches is most likely to give you an accurate statistical result? So I want you to read A through E, And think about the things that we said about trying to get good information and see what you believe is true over there.
I think it's interesting to notice about their answers that as you go down the list from A down to E, you're involving more and more people. Okay, your sample is getting larger and larger. In answer A, you've got only 1,000 people in your sample. In the answer B, you've got 10,000 people in your sample. In the answer C, you've got 100,000 people in your sample. Then you go to 2 million. And then we're just holding election, okay? So now everybody is in the sample, okay?
Does that get worse and worse because the margin of error gets bigger and bigger?
No, it's actually about how they're getting their information that makes it worse and worse, okay? Let's look down at the last one first, because that's really the one that I think most of us would go, surely that's the best thing to do, just have a national election, you find out what people think. But here's the deal, does everybody vote? Not even close, okay? And in a vote like that, where you're not really deciding anything, you're just putting in your opinion so that your congressman can know what your opinion is, how many people are actually going to head out to the poll and vote?
Not a whole lot.
Not a whole lot. And the ones that do will be on the two extremes. They will feel passionately in favor or passionately not in favor. And everybody else in the middle is going to go, yeah, whatever, I'm a busy person, okay, and not going to come. So the reason that actually ends up giving you less information about what everyone believes is because not everyone is participating. They have the opportunity to, but they're not. And so then we go up from there, and we do different things. So in D, people get to call in. Again, here's the same thing. People that call in for whatever thing are passionate. They feel strongly on one side or the other. You really don't get those middle-of-the-road people to do that sort of thing. Let's see. In answer C, how many of you are at the grocery store at 9 a.m. on Monday?
I'm doubting
anybody that I'm talking to is at the grocery store at 9 a.m. on Monday.
We're all
kind of at work then, okay? So this skews who you're going to have. You're going to have a great opinion about what retired people think and stay-at-home moms, okay? And you're really not going to know what anybody else thinks because they're not there. Maybe whoever's employed at the store. Then let's see, in B, what do we have here going on? People who've been hospitalized in the past year. Yeah, well, if I had large medical bills in the past year, then I am going to, you know, have a different opinion about a healthcare plan than somebody who has not had a large medical bill in 10 years.
And paying large.
And is resenting being told they have to buy insurance. I mean, one of the groups that was most strongly against this health bill when it was initially being done were people who had chosen to remain unemployed because they were young, they were healthy, they were willing to take the risk. They didn't want to pay and pay and pay and never, ever have a claim. They said, you know what, I'll pay into my savings account. If I have a claim, I can cover it. But I don't want to do this. And so that, you know, that's good. You're not going to find any of those people in this group because these people all have. So it turns out this relatively small group is actually your best study group overall. They're the most random sample, and you get them all to participate. And you would actually have a better sense of what everybody thought.
I guess they're saying it's not biased by saying randomly selected, but I just kind of thought whenever they were saying professional polling organization, that could then like somehow skew the data, bias it, but I guess if it's randomly selected, it doesn't.
Right. When they say a professional polling organization, you know, they're saying somebody who does this all the time for various groups, individual businesses, schools, whatever, you know, so they don't have a buy-in on the particular thing that you're studying. They just are good at doing studies. They're set up to do it. So that's all that means. All right, let's see. Number 48 on page 299. Number 48 on page 299. In a CNN poll of 500 adults nationwide, 62% of those surveyed answered yes to the question, do you favor a law to ban the sale of assault weapons and semi-automatic rifles? The margin of error was plus or minus 4.4 percentage points. Would you claim that a majority of Americans support such a law? Steve says yes. Hannah's giving me a thumbs up. What's the low end of our margin on that one? Did anybody actually do the math?
57.6.
She did that all without her calculator. I, on the other hand, pulled out my calculator just to play it safe. Okay. 57.6 is well above majority. Majority just implies more than 50. Okay. And that's the low end. Then there's the higher end. So we can say with confidence, based on this particular survey, that that is a true statement.
All right, which is all we're asked to state in that particular one. All right, let's move on then and look at 5B.
And it appears I do not have slides for the rest of these, so I shall just lecture for you. I'll get my pen out. I can do this. Let's start. This is supposed to be the unit where we talk about, should I believe it or not believe it? How valid do I think a particular study is?
And what should I be looking at
when I'm trying to determine that?
Sure. I don't think we ever discussed population parameters. Is that going to come up in a little while?
No, okay. It was that. Okay, so you were talking about population parameters.
Okay, yeah. So like on the questions on the practice quiz, I was confused because I was trying to figure out, like, so the questions I was looking at on the practice quiz, can I talk about that?
Yeah, you can talk about that.
Okay, so it was talking about how there was a set of nurses, and it was saying, like, in the U.S., And there were 250 nurses in the United States. And almost there.
That was poor spelling. I'll work on that. I think that's the word they use.
So I got this wrong, and I think I figured out how to get it right, but I want to know.
Okay, that's fine. That's absolutely fine.
So the question is, a researcher is interested in the level of stress among emergency researchers. A researcher is interested in the level of stress among emergency room nurses in the U.S.
Okay.
275, not 250.
Okay.
Emergency room nurses were interviewed to determine their level of stress. Each nurse was assigned a stress rating on his or her answer to a number of questions. The average stress rating for the 275 nurses was determined.
Okay.
Identify the population parameter.
Okay. Okay, it
didn't tell you what their stress rating was. It just said that it was assigned based upon a survey that they took, some questions that they answered. Okay, so stress rating based on survey. Okay, so these four terms all come into play here. Let's try to think about all four of them.
Okay.
All right, so what we really want to know about is all nurses or all emergency personnel? How big was our population?
The level of stress among emergency room nurses in the entire U.S.
Okay, so these are, our population is
ER nurses in the U.S.
Okay, all of them.
Okay.
Okay, that's my population. That's who I'd like to be able to say something about. Okay, that's what I'm studying. So that's my population. But it's not going to be practical for me to interview or send a survey to and get one back every single ER nurse in the whole U.S. So we cut it down and we get our sample. So our sample was 275 nurses that we actually did give this survey and assign a stress rating to. Okay, so then our sample statistic is whatever the stress rating was.
Wait, which we don't have.
They didn't give it to us, but we're going to.
But we can fill it in for that. Okay.
Yeah.
Stress rating of the 275.
Which is what I answered. No, I answered the average stress rating of the 275. So yes. I answered which that is, question.
Yes, you answered this one. You gave the sample statistic. Because the statistic and the parameter are almost always numbers. Whereas the population and the sample are almost groups of people. Mm-hmm. Yeah, most of the time. Mm-hmm. So you knew you needed a number, you had a 50-50, right?
Which, okay. Only one of them had a number, and it was that one.
Okay, so then what does it say about your population parameter? What kind of answer choices do I have?
I've got all emergency room nurses in the U.S., which we know is population.
Yep.
Average stress rating for all. Nurses in the U.S., which would be sample statistic, right?
No. My sample statistic was the average stress rating for those 275 people. You just found your answer. I take this and I say, I am saying that if my sample is valid, well-selected, truly represents my population, then what I got as my sample statistic is also going to be true for the entire population, within usually a plus or minus something, okay? But,
okay.
So this is the average stress rating.
Yes. And I was thinking, well, it can't possibly be that because
we're not talking to all those people.
We aren't assessing them, but.
That's how statistical research works.
Not only the small that you, it's like the biggest thing that you're looking for.
So because it refers to the population, it has to refer to everybody, all ER nurses. And the parameter is directly associated with statistic. Like I said, it's a number, usually. Okay?
Got it. Thank you.
That makes sense?
Yeah.
Okay. If you want further practice on that, page 288, example one.
Does a couple more in the book.
Where they kind of talk about all four of these words. They give you a little scenario, and then they talk about all four of those words and how they're used. Okay.
Thank you.
You're welcome. Okay, anybody else want to ask something about 5A before we move forward to 5B?
No, thank you.
All right, then thank you, because now I've got my whiteboard on and I can't see you at home, so you must do the shout out thing, because I apparently did not get my slides online like I thought, so I have to work on that one later. Okay, so 5B, the big thing in 5B is making a judgment call about the validity of a statistical study. Should I believe it? Should I not? Okay, and on page 301,
they give you a list of 8 things.
Now,
I'm not telling you memorize this list of 8 things,
okay? But you should, you know, read them and have at least most of them make enough sense that when you're reading a statistical study or you see a quote about a statistical study, you can stop and ask yourself some of these key questions.
All right. And so
the headings in the book, you know, kind of give you an idea of how to look at this. Guideline number one is just step back and look at the big picture. Okay. What was the goal? What population were they talking about? Was it observational or was it an experiment? Okay. Make sure you're thinking about what kind of statistic are we even thinking about here? Okay. Then if you step back and thought about that, the second really important thing to do is to consider who's doing this research. It turns out for years, it's really sad, tobacco companies knew that their product was injuring people's health, but because they were doing their own research, remarkably, their interpretation of that research kept being, oh no, it's fine. It's why they got hit with such huge judgments when people did independent research and proved it wrong. Because then they could go back and look and go, you knew all along and you just lied. Okay? You just played with the numbers in order to say something that you knew was not true. But it wasn't in their interest to say that cigarettes were harming people, so they just chose not to say that. All right. So you want to look at the source. Source is really, really important.
Who's doing this research?
Like, for example, if the people researching the prescription drug are the ones
that are testing the prescription drug. Exactly.
Then okay. That's good.
Yeah. When in the case of medications, you know, big pharmaceutical companies develop. They pour tons of money into research, developing these medications. We're glad that they do this, okay? But they do testing. They do testing, and when they think that their testing shows, hey, we've got a good one here, this one is a winner, we don't just put it on the market. There's then that step two, where it goes to the FDA. And the FDA does their own testing, independent from the pharmaceutical company, because the FDA hasn't poured any money into this research, so they don't have any reason to be biased, and so they're taking a non-biased point of view. This is why people get concerned if it seems like big pharmaceutical companies are a little too buddy-buddy with people that are on the FDA board, because then you start to say, is this really independent research or not? Mm-hmm. Okay. But you want to look at the source of your study. You want to make certain that nobody is biased who's actually conducting the study. Then you want to look for bias in your sample. Okay, remember when you choose your sample, you want your sample to look like your population. Okay, so, you know, if I want to do a study on the general health of university students, and I go and get my entire sample group from the athletic dorms, I've got a biased study. Okay? They do not represent the students at large, okay, throughout that entire thing. So you want to look for, is there some kind of bias in this study? Okay? Not by who's doing it, but by how they chose their group. If they let people volunteer, that usually leads to bias. You know, that becomes a convenient sampling. They all turned up and said they wanted to be in it, you know. So you want to look through those things as well. Okay, then guideline number four, you're looking for problems in how they define or measure their variable of interest. What was the one we looked at the beginning? Let's see, we were trying to figure out, it was for ADHD. And they claimed that it made students
more polite and less disruptive.
Yes, the claim was
less disruptive.
And then the measurement, such as it was,
the measurement was more polite.
And we had a lot of concerns about that, being very fuzzy, very hard to measure. One doesn't necessarily measure the other. So many problems with that. And so this is the kind of thing you're talking about when they talk in guideline four, look for problems in defining or measuring the variable of interest, okay? Did they do a good job of deciding how that was going to happen. So they talk about Nielsen ratings in the textbook, but let's go to example four and just look at the example they put in there. A Roper poll, Roper is another independent study group, reported in USA Today involved a survey of the wealthiest 1% of Americans. The survey found that these people would pay an average of $487,000 for true love and $407,000 for great intellect and $285,000 for talent and $259,000 for eternal youth. And so then we go, okay, they say evaluate this particular study. Based upon this, problems for defining or measuring the variable of interest. How do we, you know, define true love? How do we define some of these other things? Great intellect, talent. Because these variables are so poorly defined, you know, what people were claiming they were willing to purchase may not have been the same thing.
Well,
for every person.
What true love is, I mean, all of those things are relative.
Right.
You could think someone to sing classical music is talented, and I think that they're boring.
Right.
So it's all, since it's too relative.
Right. And I know many people think that hip-hop stars are talented, and I have trouble just even staying in the same room with the music on. So, you know, there's all this relative scale of things going on. These things are very hard to define. We're not going to define them in the same way. So then when these people say, hey, I'll pay this much money for it, we don't even know what they're trying to buy, for sure. No less if it's valid, okay?
A commonly quoted statistic for illegal drugs.
I know this one was in my slides. Law enforcement authorities succeed in stopping only about 10 to 20% of the illegal drugs entering the United States. Is this a valid statistic? How do I prove that?
Well, then you would have to knowingly not get the other 80 to 90%.
Well, I mean, how do you show 80 to 90%
not found?
Get through. Yeah. Aren't found. Get through. Based on what?
We're not
standing at the border letting, okay, 8 out of 10 people come on across, even though we see them carrying illegal drugs. Clearly not doing that, okay? The people working at the border are making every effort to catch everybody that they can, okay? So then how do we come up with this number? How do we prove that some of them are getting through? Let's ask an easier question first. Somebody that's at home tonight, how do we know for sure that some of them are getting through?
Probably because of the amount of... Can you hear me?
Are you Sarah?
Yes.
Hi, Sarah. I didn't even know you were on, so I'm glad you spoke up so I know you're here. Hi. Now, go ahead with your thought.
Probably because the police catch a certain number of illegal drugs on the other side.
Right.
Here in the U.S.,
we have not run out of people to arrest with drugs, okay? So because we find the product in the U.S. and we know for a fact that much of that product is not grown or produced here, okay? We know that clearly it got through, okay? So we can determine that some's getting through. Not arguing that. We're not catching everybody at the border. Some of the product is coming through. That, I think, we can prove. But how do we prove 80 or 90%? We can't, okay? We can't. And so, you know, I forget. They've got a phrase in here, PFA. Pulled from the air, okay? That's what police call it. We just picked a number, we threw it out there because we think it's a big problem, so we picked a big number, okay? If we thought it was a small problem, we'd pick a small number, but the fact is, we're just picking a number, okay? We can't really calculate that number. We do not have any statistics to back it, all right? No one's counted how many people got across
without getting arrested, because if we saw
them, we would arrest them. And so that's
the kind of thing
you want to look for. Are they claiming something that's not even calculable? Okay, if I can't calculate it, then no, that's not valid.
Beware of confounding
variables is guideline, the next guideline. I don't know what number we're on.
I wanted to talk about this one.
There, I think it was your quiz I was looking at. You had a question. I think you missed that question. And they said that the correct answer was confounding variables. Do you happen to just remember that question?
No, but I can look it up.
Would you please? It was really a good question. I wanted to talk about it. And when I glanced, it was in my slides that didn't make the trip with me. And so now I need a better memory than I have. So if you would help me, I would appreciate it. Confounding variables. Sometimes two things run together, they coincide. And so we think we're looking at one thing, but we may in fact be looking at something else instead, or one may be confusing the other. I was trying to think, there's a high percentage of students.
Has to do with ADHD. ADHD
runs more
or is prevalent amongst students that also have
behavior
that's not related to the ADHD, but we're like, no,
everything's related to ADHD. But in fact, no, it's usually classified as behavior disorders. And so sometimes kids don't get diagnosed with the behavior disorder and they don't get the right interventions for that because everybody's just blaming the ADHD, because those two things do tend to run together, but sometimes they're misidentified and we think it's one and not the other. The ADHD, it might be both. They could have both, but you have different treatments for this than this that are effective. And so if all you're doing is treating the ADHD and the kid actually has this, then you're not really giving them all the help they could have, but we just don't see it. You know, we're maybe more reluctant to diagnose this or whatever. So that's one thing that I can remember just in my readings as an educator, that this goes on. And so we have to watch out for those kinds of things. The book uses an example about radon and lung cancer, okay, for confounding variables. But there was a good one in the practice quiz, and Sarah's going to help me out with this. I hope.
So the question was, I don't think I got it right. Is that what you said?
I don't think you did. But when I read it, I went, oh yeah, I see why she got tricked by that. That's really a good example of this. So I wanted to use it. Go ahead.
Okay, so the question is, educational researcher wishes to compare the effectiveness of two different math textbooks. Is that one?
That's the one, yes. Okay. When you say
she has the 10th graders at one school use the first book for 1 year, and the 10th graders at another school use the second book for 1 year. At the end of the year, she gives the same math test to both classes and compares the results.
And the results are different, right?
Or she picks.
Yes.
So she does this and then she goes, oh, see, these scores were higher. Well, I don't even think it says whose are higher. We'll just say these were higher.
And so then,
because these guys had higher scores, she goes, this is the best book. Okay. Do her two groups, or two classes of students, are they alike?
Not necessarily. There's two different schools. It could be from two different social groups in the city.
Exactly. One could be in the city and one could be in the country. One could be in a high rent, you know, highly educated population, and the other one could be in the inner city where nobody has a parent with a college education. The only thing we know for sure these two groups have in common is they're all in the 10th grade.
And they're all in a math class.
And they're all in a math class. After that, we don't know anything, okay? And so to assume that it was all about the textbook, in fact, here, let's throw this out.
Do they have the same teacher?
No.
No.
And, you know, most studies say, believe it or not, my job makes a difference. Okay, so the teacher in the room can impact, you know, how well students do. And certainly all those other factors that we talked about, we know impact how students do. You know, those high-income schools like Highland Park, those schools, you know, I mean, they blow off every test. It's amazing. But they're paying. When my UIL team had to compete against them this year, we're lucky enough to be in their region group, yay us. And they not only had a class during the school day to study just their UIL competition materials, but they have tutors that get paid $75 an hour to work with their team after school. My poor little team just gets one day a week out of me second semester, and I do not get paid anything for it. I got to tell you, they're not getting the same amount of preparation to compete. So, you know, there are things that money will buy and will make a difference. And so to say that this is a valid study and sure enough we now know textbook A is definitely the better book is just not the case, because we have too many other variables.
These are confounding variables.
My two groups are not similar enough that I can determine it's the book that made the difference.
In this case, wouldn't it be better to do like one semester with one book and give them a test, and then the next semester, the same teacher, same class, do the other book and then do a test?
Yeah, well, and only if you're going to teach the same material both semesters, which you wouldn't. Because, like, for instance, as an Algebra 2 teacher, I know that semester 1, 3/4 of what I teach my students, they have already been exposed to. And I'm just trying to take them a little deeper into it. Whereas in semester 2, everything I teach them is brand new to them. So most students score lower second semester than first. And it's not really because I fell apart, and it's not really because they fell apart. It's just because the material is less familiar to them, so it's harder for them to learn at the same level. What you're proposing would absolutely work if I was teaching first semester material both times. But even if not, it still might not be valid. Okay? But we'd be getting closer at that point. We'd definitely be getting closer.
So even school data would be tricky then, because each year the academia of a class would change. Mm-hmm. So, like, because, like, I remember whenever my class graduated from my high school, everyone talked about, oh, you guys, such a great class. The next class was a poor class. I mean, like, it was categorized poorly performing class.
Right. And so then their teachers take a beating. How come you didn't prepare these as well as the others? And they're like, hey, these aren't the same students that we taught last year. You know, and so.
I'm sorry,
well,
I don't
want to
get too far off, but.
Not always. The classic way in which it is not is U.S. versus European
or Asian countries. Okay.
You know, they release studies every single year. We took this test, and the U.S. is getting further and further behind. Oh, doomsday. We're never going to survive. It's so bad. Okay. Because we do not come up with as good of scores as European schools or Asian schools. And as U.S. teachers, we get so tired of hearing this, we want to scream. U.S. schools all take everybody.
I just like to remind everybody, they're all there, okay?
You know, those brilliant genius kids that are taking pre-AP Algebra 2 or pre-Cal, their eighth grade year, yeah, we have those. And then the kids that are nonverbal, okay, and what we have those two, okay, and everybody in between, and the great majority of them take those tests. When they look at our scores, they're looking at our scores for the entire student body, okay? When you talk about European and Asian schools, by the time you get to high school, you know, they have weeded out a substantial percentage of their students that they don't let into their university-bound high schools. They're going to the trade school-bound schools. It's a very different situation. So we're only looking at their higher students. And so we're competing with, you know, not every single person in my building, but 75 to 80% of our students take the tests. So 75 or 80% of our students are having to compete against their top
20, maybe 30%.
Like that's an apples and oranges kind of thing, okay? But the average person reading those studies doesn't know that. They don't know the difference between how the school systems work. I teach every year in my classroom kids from Korea and Hong Kong and China whose families have sacrificed a ton to bring them to the U.S. because they already at 12 or 13 or 14 had been judged not university material and they were not going to be allowed to go to the university in their country. And so the only way that those kids can go to university is if their parents bring them to the U.S. And sometimes they come and live with an aunt or an uncle or whatever, and sometimes the whole family comes, all right? And it's just so their students can go to college. Please remember when they're saying how bad our schools are that the whole world still comes to the U.S. to go to college. And our students are holding up there, so it can't be all bad. Confounding variables can be real tricky to see. Consider the wording. Sometimes the wording is skewed to lead the person towards the conclusion that they want you to have. If they were in a court of law, the lawyer would say objection leading the witness, okay? But it's a study and not a court of law, so you have to judge that. You have to recognize that.
That was one of the questions on the practice quiz too, was like, how is this study flawed? And the answer was that because...
We've already told you it's flawed, so figure out what's wrong with it.
Right.
You know?
And so, well, but it was because of the wording. Like, it asked you, how is it flawed? And so one of them was because of the wording. And yes. You could tell that the person had a very negative tone. So if I ask you a question in a negative way, you're probably going to be more inclined to answer negatively than if I had asked it to you in a positive way.
Right. Yes, that's definitely true.
Then the last two are look at how they
present their results. Are they presented fairly? And step back and just think about the conclusions. At the end of the day, even if you can't really sort out what's wrong with it, why you don't like it, but it just smells fishy, it doesn't seem right, then there's probably a good chance there is something that's not right. You at least want to investigate further before you go buy the swampland in Louisiana or whatever they're proposing that you should do. Because there may well be something wrong, okay? Notice in that section, there is absolutely no math to do, all right? There are no calculations in that section. It's just trying to think about when you hear statistics, what should you think about after that? You know, what should come to mind? How can you make an evaluation of how accurate they are?
All right, so
that moves us into 5C. And this is where I'm going to feel sad about my slides.
Because we start talking about statistical tables and graphs.
And they have some nice charts, and I always draw them so poorly. They're drawn so nice, but we'll go with this, all right? Statistical tables and graphs. And the two big ones that they talk about, well, maybe three, they talk about frequency tables. And then they talk about bar graphs and pie charts,
okay?
Those three things come up in this. And I think, just to jump into this, since I don't have my slides, I'm going to jump into a question. We're going to work our way through the question and then see if we can think about everything that we did. So I want to look at number 16 from page 321. It's about a website that's reviewing recent movies and ranking them by stars, okay? So they ranked them as either
a 5-star, 4-star, 3-star, 2-star, One star.
Okay, movie. And let me see here. I believe
I've got the right
data down here. Correct me if I start to put a number up here that doesn't agree with what they have. Okay. In the frequency column, frequency just means how many were judged that way. So there were five movies that they judged to be five-star movies. And there were 10 movies that they judged to be four-star.
There were 20
that got the three-star marking, 15 that earned only 2 stars, and 5 that earned 1 star. Okay, so that's just our frequency. Okay, this is how often did this rating happen in the total number of movies that I looked at. Okay, now it's going to be important for us to know what is that total number. So we need to add them here
and find out
what's the total number of movies that we considered. So 20, 30, 45, 50, 55. 55 movies were reviewed. And so we're just looking at other reviewers and we're looking at how they did it for these 55 movies. This is our total. Okay, so frequency is the first one. Then we talk about relative frequency.
Now, by now, we should have figured out that when this word relative comes up,
now we're talking about a percentage value, okay? We're comparing two things, all right? So we want to know 5 out of 55 and 10 out of 55
and 20, whoops, another 5, 20 out of 55 and 15 out of 55, and 5 out of 55. And for each of these,
I want to do that calculation, and if I'm going to write it as a percentage, then I'm going to need to take it times 100, parts per 100, okay? So let's see. Sarah, I want you to do my 5 out of 55. Robbie, are you still with me?
Yes, ma'am.
Great. Would you calculate 10 out of 55? Steve, I'm pretty sure you're in my audience. Would you do 20 out of 55? Who else do I have at home? I think I've got one more. Christina?
Yes.
Yeah, Hannah's coaching me here. She knows you all. 15 out of 55, and Hannah's going to do 5 out of 55. And I'm going to ask you for your number here in just a minute.
Well, mine will be the same as Sarah's.
Yours will be the same as Sarah's. So all right.
I'll just let her play.
Okay, Sarah, what did you get?
I got... You wanted the percentage, right?
I do.
Okay, 11%?
Hannah doesn't seem to agree. Hannah, what do you think it is? She has the 1 star down here that are the same numbers.
Well, according to my calculations, it would be
9.09%. And Hannah says it's 9.09.
Okay.
So that could be.
We would do 5 divided by 55, and then we would do times 100. Okay, so 5 divided by 55 times 100. You're going to go with her 9.09? Okay, so I will edit here. All right, who has my 4-star number? 10 out of 55 is what percent?
18%? Or 18.18 or 2?
Okay, however we want to round it. There we
right.
go.
Okay, very good. And then 20 out of 55 for the 3-star movies, what was that number?
36.4%.
All right, 36.4.
And then the 2-star movies?
I get to 27.27.
All right.
Okay, which makes sense because this one is smaller than this one, but more than this one. I mean, relatively speaking, these numbers all make sense to us. Now, if our math is really good and we didn't round too much, what should this column add up to? It should be 100, right? This is all the movies that we did, so they should total roughly 100%. So add somebody that likes their calculator, add that column up and see how close we are to 100%. We did some rounding, but we should be pretty close.
Are we close?
So I cut the decimals off and I got 99%.
Okay, so with the decimals, 274 would be 67, 77, and 80 is 85. Oh yeah, we're very close.
To get, we can get
that other percentage point back. Okay, so that's our calculations are validated as being true. Okay, and then cumulative frequency. This is the last column that you sometimes see.
I don't know, 1M or 2. Somebody want to help me with cumulative? I usually just abbreviate it. See
you. One, there's one.
Thank you. There we go.
For those that are watching later, I'd like them to know what that was supposed to stand for.
Okay, so cumulative frequency is when we're just adding as we go. Sometimes you would switch these two columns, okay? You never know how they're going to choose to organize it. So the first one, I only had that one, so it was 5. The second one is 5 plus 10, so it's 15. And then 15 plus 20
is 35.
And 35 plus 15, now we're at 50, and then we get to add 5 more in there, and so now we're at 55. This number should always equal this number, your total, okay, if you've added properly. So it's kind of a check on your total value. Okay, so in question 16, they said a website reviews these movies, here are the ratings, and you're supposed to make a frequency table for the data, and they give us the columns that we're supposed to include. So this is our frequency table for what they ask for. So is everybody okay with how I built my frequency table?
Yes.
On your test, because the bulk of your test is multiple choice, it would probably be you have this data and then you'd have 3 or 4 tables to choose from and you'd have to say which table is the correct representation.
So we want to do the math to figure out if the percentages are right.
Exactly.
Like we did, and then we'll do
that. Yeah, I would just ignore their answers, build my table, and then compare my table to the answers, okay? Rather than just trying to do the whole I'm in a hurry, I bet I can guess the right one thing, I would just do the problem and then look at the answers would be my advice. So this is kind of what they're asking you to do. Now, often this has been converted to, say, a pie chart. A pie chart is great when you're totaling 100%, okay? Because then you're just thinking about how big a piece of the pie do each one of these things get. So we know that 1-star movies and 5-star movies should have the same size slice. And it should be the smallest slices of the pie, all right? Because they have the least number in them. The largest slice of the pie is my 20, which is 36.4%, which I know is a little bit more than a third. Now see, this is where the drawing starts to get.
It's pretty sad, not gonna lie.
We'll call it that one. So these are my 3-star movies. Okay, who have a little more than a third of the pie, because they have more than 33.3%. They're at 36. The next largest piece should be the 2-star movies. They are less than a third, okay? Together, these two total, where's my percentages? They total 50, 63, almost 64%. So they're more than half.
So
So I'll give this one to my two-star movies. No, that right now. So they would go there. And so on and so forth. If I needed to actually draw this graph, I am old enough to remember when I had to do this, okay? Then I would say, what is 36.4% of the degrees in the circle? Anybody got that number for me? Say ahead, it says 360 degrees. So I take 36.4% of 360, and then I take my protractor out, and I measure that size angle, and then I draw my pie chart. Now, those of you that are substantially younger than me are like, you have got to be kidding, lady, okay? There's this thing called Excel. Yes, there is, okay? And Excel is a wonderful thing because it makes absolutely beautiful pie charts, and it'll make bar graphs. It'll make all kinds of nice, pretty things. And all you do is put in your data, okay? And then it does everything else for you. So much of this that my teacher spent, you know, significant class time teaching me how to do by hand is really no longer relevant because I'm just going to let my computer do this. It's going to look better than my product would look, and it's much faster. One of your portfolio questions is I give you a set of data. I send you to a question that gives you a set of data, and you construct two graphs for me with Excel, and you don't even have to write anything about it, okay? You just put the data in, and you get it. So
I guess I could just look through them. I'm not sure.
Chances are it is in this section.
Okay.
So I'm going to guess.
Yeah, it's 54 and 55.
You have to do the bar graph and the pie chart. So it'll say
5C.
Got it.
You would pick, I want to do question 5C, and that's one of the things you can submit. So, you know, if you're looking for that low-hanging fruit to get through those 10 things, here's one for most of us. Now, if you're as old as I am, you may go, oh, I think I'd rather do it by hand, and I understand your pain, but a lot of people are good at this, so that's what's going on. So this is the frequency chart. We know, you know, I sat here and just started building this thing by hand. Now I want you to think about this question on a multiple choice test. You know 3-star has to have the biggest slice. You know 15 has to be next. You know 10 has to be next. You know you have to have two that are equal. And you know what their labels have to be. You know, you can probably almost at a glance pick the right one if you're just using common sense. Okay? But you can certainly also calculate these and you might... if you're also having to match a table, then you might need to, okay? But sometimes they have answer choices that are just crazy, you know? It's like they said 5-star movies was the big category. You're like, what were you looking at? So they're not always difficult decisions to make.
All right, this is
really all that they're asking you to do in here. I didn't write down anything else that I particularly wanted to talk about in this section. I think this covers it. It's really just bar graphs, pie charts. I guess I didn't talk specifically about a bar graph. If we were going to do a bar graph for this data, let me erase my...
Yeah, I'll use it.
My circle over here. And we'll think about what a bar graph would look like for this same.
Your bars would be labeled 5-star, 4-star, 3-star, 2-star, 1-star.
And down here, you would have units of measure in percentages.
That is very terrible looking. 10%, 20%, 30%, 40%.
We don't have any numbers bigger than that, so we can stop there. I can make my chart fit in the space that I have. So where I have 5%, that would, or 5-star movies were only, it fell short of 10%.
So I'm gonna have a bar out here that doesn't quite reach 10.
four-star movies, we're at 18.18%, not quite 20.
So I want something that's a little short of 20.
Then I get here, 36.4% is about halfway between 30 and 40. And so on and so forth. Okay. So again, this is how you would construct a bar graph. You need to make certain that your labels are clear. We know which bar is representing which numbers and why. You should label your units down here so we have some idea of what we're talking about there. But I don't think anyone would struggle with doing that, truthfully.
Any
other questions from 5C? Anybody remember anything from the practice quiz that you think was related to this? If you want to take a moment and open up your practice quiz and go, wait, stop, let's talk about this.
It'd be a good time.
I'd like to finish this section and then let you have a break. No questions?
Yeah, for me.
All right. Well, you know, hopefully you're all starting to think, hey, this thing got a little easier this week than it was last week. And I would agree. I think that this week's material is much more accessible than last week's, certainly from a calculation perspective. It's a lot easier. Okay, so let's take a 20-minute break. We'll meet back at 8:20, and we'll finish out this chapter at that time.